I'm going to offer a little prayer if I don't forget it.
Good morning.
My name is Mickey, and I'm an alcoholic.
My name is Marie, and I'm a very grateful Al-Anon.
It's so good to be with you. We were over in the restaurant to have breakfast this morning, and the place was thinning out, and this man and his wife were having their breakfast, and he leans back at his table and he says, "Are you here for a conference?" I said, "Yes." He said, "What is it?" And I go, "Alcoholics Anonymous." Lepers Anonymous. And he loved it. He loved that we were doing this. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that just great? I'd like to start with a little prayer. Good morning, God. You're ushering in another day, untouched and freshly new. And here we come and ask you, God, if you'll renew us too. Forgive the many errors that we made yesterday. And help us once again, dear Lord, to walk closer in your way. But Father, we are well aware we can't make it on our own. So take our hands and hold them tight. For we can't walk alone. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okie dokie. Here we go again. So we're going to look at step two. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. From the chapter, We Agnostics. In the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. It's not rocket science. They didn't write that. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea it was a spiritual program. And I got in here and I thought, oh my God. What are they going to do? They're going to try to cure me with fairy tales? What is this? I'm going to die. So I hooked up with some people, and I had this sponsor who had these blue eyes. He could look through a steel door. And I said, you know, this was after a few weeks. I said, could we get together for lunch? And he said, sure. I said, good. And because I had this plan, and don't we all? So I walked into this Mexican restaurant that we were going to have lunch at, and he has the entire crew sitting around the table. So I thought, well, yeah, I got to get out of here because this is Fairy Tales Anonymous. And so I said, well, guys, here's what it is. I figured out I'm not alcoholic. I really want to thank you. But I'm not alcoholic. And so the head dude looks at me and he says, really? He says, Mickey, there's a bar on the other side of the restaurant. Come on over, I'll buy you a drink. And it was like my rear end was riveted to the chair. And I looked at him and I said, I can't do that. He said, why? I said, if I do that, I'll go to hell. And he said, and you're not alcoholic? So that whole discussion was over. And they didn't offer me a plan B. A plan B is you can just cruise through this thing, rely on yourself, you know, and the sun will break out and the angels will sing and it's going to be okay. It's not true. So, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. There's a phrase that we use in Alcoholics Anonymous, some of us, and we say the spiritual side of the program. I don't think there's any other side. I just don't think it, because where am I going to go for help? When I was drinking, I crashed some poor priest's rectory in the middle of the night. I went to, psychologists. I went to my family. I cried on Marie's shoulder. I got nothing.
To one who feels he's an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I'm just going to ask, is there any other variety that you can think of? Sorry, Bill. And this is probably one of our most favorite phrases, sentences in the book. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Only an alcoholic is going to look at a proposition like that and give it one of these. I don't know, death, you know, live on a spiritual basis. So when I came in here, I had been raised in my faith all the way through college. You know, I had a minor in theology. I had all of this stuff. And the conclusion I had drawn was that God sent people like me to hell. So, you know, what are we going to do? And they said, well, Mickey, you can have any God you want, any God that you can do business with. And that offer is still on the table for anyone who may be on the ropes right now. I mean, we don't have to come in and have anybody else's God. We can have a God we can do business with. So I wrote my God down on a piece of paper. I want a God who understands the connection between things. I looked at this because it's my understanding, as an example, that a baby, when it's in his crib, they think this, that it might be the possibility. The baby holds up its hand, and it doesn't know that these things that we call fingers or wiggling are part of his arm or her arm. They don't have it all connected. I did not have the world connected. I would sit in the last days of my drinking and I'd look out the front window, terribly sick from having been drinking all night, and I'd look out the window and say, why aren't they all out blowing each other up? Why aren't we all completely at war? Well, the war was in me. So I had this God now, and I'm going to go into the world with my God. And so Marie had longer hair, and I didn't realize, besides the fact that I think it looks really great, I would braid her hair. And there was a connection between those braids, and it was starting to bring me in for a landing because I'm crazy as a whatever. And then I met George, and George took me under his wing. And he, as I told you in the earlier session, George was studying to be a Methodist minister. So he went to his sacred shop with books, you know, and plaques and the things you can get there. And he got me this little card, and it had a picture on it. It was a wood carving of a big hand and a little child leaning into the hand. And there was a quote from the prophet Isaiah. See, I will not forget you. I have carved you on the palm of my hand. And that became my God. And I carried my card around. And when I would go to sleep at night, I would put that card on the wall. See, I will not forget you. I've carved you on the palm of my hand. Now, if you think this weekend is going to be a Hallmark card, you're right. The gentleness, the kindness shown to us by the God who's drawn us in here because he doesn't want to throw us away. We are special people. I'm going to underline that so many times because it's literally true. So we start off that journey, and it's like going from fairy tales to that is a pretty excellent trip. Now, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. And of course, I would fall back on that. You know, if I click my heels 3 times, is it going to be okay? You know, if I really have a positive attitude, if I smile a lot, if I do something, is this going to go away? No, the answer is no. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. Lack of power. So this guy told me early on in sobriety, he said, it's like, Mickey, if you went over to a public service company and stuck your finger in one of those big transformers. We're talking about power. We're talking about power. We had to have lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how, pardon me, were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. So we're trying to survive. The alcohol is out of our system. We're going to get rolling on this deal. And thank God there are other people that have, like Dave said, that have come before us. And my sponsor, 3 tours in Vietnam. I asked him one time, I said, George, tell me about being a Navy medic attached to the Marines in Vietnam. Talk to me about that. And all he said to me was this. He said, Mickey, it was sacred. This tremendous love. And so George and I started down this road. And I told you what a blockhead I was getting started. I don't know that I've progressed much, but I... And George would just talk to me. And there was a Broadway musical called Pippin. I don't know if you're familiar with that musical. Marie and I actually saw that in New York. It was wonderful. And George gave me a record of Pippin. And there was a song in there that the guy sings, and he says, take it easy, baby, you're on the right path. And I listened to that over and over and over. And George, I would call him, and I'd say, I'm not doing so well, George. And he said, it's always darkest before the dawn. And I would call George, and I'd say, George, is it almost dawn? I was scared to death. And I mean, I was coming in on fumes, you know what I mean? I was coming in on fumes, and I had no place to go other than George and go into meetings. And so we start down the road, and I could believe in the God George had. You know, George survived polio when he was a kid. He had polio in his throat, in his throat. And he would go to sleep at night, and he'd wake up in the morning, and there'd be 3 beds that were empty because those boys had died of polio. And George is gay. And George was 3 tours in Vietnam. And he looked at me and he said, Mickey, we are survivors. We are survivors. And we owe an obligation because we've survived to do this work, because the work's not just for us. It's for somebody else. So we do the work. So... would you like to share?
Sure.
Mrs. Yu?
This is my favorite part of the program, simply because it was the dividing line between my old life and my new life. I was coming into this program with not even a hint that there was something outside of us, outside of our own spirit, our own understanding. And so I didn't have to erase anything on the blackboard of my heart. I just didn't have to erase anything. I had no prejudices coming in, except that my dad would always say, you know, God is a concept that's really, you know, just for the poor people in the world, just to keep them, you know, okay. And so I had that in my head for a long, long time. But basically, looking at God, I had no past feelings about that. And so coming in, I got to discover. And I think that's how my experience has been. I've been discovering God. And I have a natural, it's a defect and it's a blessing. I don't feel things quite as deeply sometimes as Mickey or some of the other people that I know. And I look at that, you know, we're different people. And part of that has protected me from the realities of my life. And so my discovery of God has been a chipping away of that numbness. And I would discover that, oh, wow, I see God's hand in this. And so it kind of added to my understanding of God. But it was a very slow process. It was not like an awakening. They said, you know, choose a higher power. And I go, you know, okay. It was very slow. And I am, I would say I have a blindness that has to be revealed to me very, very slowly. So, but the understanding that there is something more than the rule book that I had, and I really was, you know, I came into the program and I wanted you to tell me what are the rules, I'll do it, and then I'll go on, and if I follow the rules, everything will be okay. And that was kind of put to rest because, you know, and the rule book, I think, was written by June Cleaver in Leave It to Beaver. And, you know, I tried following that, and it didn't seem to be working out, you know. I was married to an alcoholic, and it didn't seem to apply to an alcoholic marriage. But I tried. And so each and every step of the way, each and every failure that I had to manage my life in the way of, you know, finding the rule book of my life, failed. And thank God it failed, because if it didn't fail, I was kind of in the process of saying, you know, managing my own life really works. It goes really well. So each and every failure that I've had has been another understanding that we're here to do God's will. And I don't know if there was any particular place where I discovered that God was really working in my life, but it was an accumulation. And the graces, that every single thing that's ever happened to us or me has had its own grace. And I think the blessing for me, and it's a blessing when you have somebody next to you who can see those blessings despite the fact that it's really a tough thing, you know. Every tough thing has its blessing. And I guess I contribute that to God. And so I think that is the basis and the culmination and the continuing growth that I have to discovering and coming to believe every day that the power that I look to is really, really good. We have an expression, God is always good, and I believe it. And we've had a lot of tough situations in our life. And one of the things that, you know, I was taken through an exercise of writing down some of the ways in which I see that God has worked in our life. And at one point we were making a lot of money, and we bought this big, huge mansion and swimming pool and all this kind of stuff. This is one of the proofs of God for me. So we got into this house, and 6 months later, we had no money and couldn't pay the mortgage. We were like, OMG, we can't pay the mortgage. What are we going to do? Are we going to go bankrupt this week or next week? Swimming in the pool, of course. But And I remember crying myself to sleep many times. You know, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? We can't pay our mortgage. And, you know, that's a basic thing. We want to have our house with, you know, have our kids and take care of them. And when I looked back 9 years later, we were still in that house. We had paid our mortgage every month. There was never a rich uncle who left us any money. There was no, like, big miraculous whatever. He took care of us every single month. And I can't tell you how that happened. We would make a budget, and the budget said, there's no way you're going to make this. So we put the budget away, and we made it. Okay, and it is one of the first, I have other ones, share that later, but it was one of my first proofs of God. I didn't do it, Mickey didn't do it, we didn't plan for it, we didn't manipulate it, we let God take care of us, and he did. You want to take
it? I'm glad you brought that up. So it's Christmas. It's Christmas time. Now, we came in. There were circumstances in our country where people like the Clintons wanted to revamp the whole healthcare system. And so what happened was we had all these clients that were little hospitals. And so the little hospitals got frightened about what was going to happen, and they started to join in union with each other, and they got bigger than we could handle. They weren't interested in us anymore. But anyway, that was kind of on down the line. But here we go. It's coming on Christmas, and we had a three-story 1890 house, and so the kids and Marie are upstairs. I got $7.50. That's what we had, $7.50. So I went out and rented a movie. It was Space Camp. So I got a movie for the kids, and I'm sitting back behind them, and I am devastated. I got $7.50, and my family's sitting in front of me, and there's nothing I can do about it. So I'm sitting back there, and if you imagine now your mind as like cable television, and all 60 channels are on the same channel. And this voice started talking to me, and he said, Mickey, I had to get you out to a place where you couldn't do anything but rely on me. Now you hold my hand, and everything will be okay. $7.50, as Marie said, turned into 9 years. But will he do it this time?
Yeah.
Oh, am I the only one who thinks that way? So, you know, these proofs. And there came a time, ultimately, where we could not sustain it. The business just died off. And so don't we in Alcoholics Anonymous always want to be the giver and not the receiver? Do you know what I mean? If there's a need, we want to be the one who gives, not the one who receives. Well, we just couldn't make it. And so there was this lady that I didn't particularly care for, God forgive me, in the program. And she rallied a force of AAs and came over to our house, and they painted the walls so we could resell it. They painted the walls. They ripped up carpet. They weeded the gardens. They did all that thing. And all I could do was stand out in the front yard and just watch it. And it was like one of the greatest things. Did I already tell that story?
No.
It was one of the greatest things to watch this and to be the receiver, because this guy came by and he looked at me and he says, you know, I don't think I've ever had more fun in my life. Because he was able to give, and there was somebody who could receive it. Do you see what I mean? We need that connection on both sides. So don't be afraid to receive. If you're down, ask for help, and you'll get it.
Would anybody like to make a comment?
Or question?
Or a question? Okay, then we're... No, I'm just kidding. But just know, yes.
This week, I've been wrestling with jobs. So I wanted to surrender a job where I was being treated badly. And since my self-esteem started to go up, I looked at the job, I prayed about it, my sponsor said, pray about it. And I said, there's a way...
At some point, after praying about it for a couple days, it was just, God will take care of me, and it's okay to not accept work where it will not be supportive of my sobriety. And so, it was a short-term contract. I would have only had to suck it up for, you know, not a long period of time, but it was $3,500, and I just let it go, and then I didn't take it back. I just said, God will take care of it, and I went on and did whatever else needed to be done. And 72 hours later, the insurance company called and said, you put in a claim 38 months ago and we denied the claim because there was not sufficient documentation. We just did an audit of your file and we realized all the paperwork is there and we're sending you a check for $3,500 this
morning. Thank you. Thank
That's
you.
That's wonderful. You want to tell about Bingo King now or no?
Yeah. So it's not a competition. I'd win. So we came to a place after we lost our house. We moved in with my mom. We packed all of our stuff in her garage, and I started looking for work. And I'd been looking for work, and I couldn't find a job. I'd been in advertising 25 years. And I thought, you know, that when I left advertising, there'd be like a parade. Something, you know, Mickey, you've done so great and whatever. And what it really was like, what happens if you stick your fist in a bowl of water and you lift it out, there's nothing. It was like, adios, muchacho. So I got a job in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, finally. They dug the kind of advertising that I made. Went up there, and I did not do well. We were just... strangers in a strange land. And so we tried to do our job. I tried to do my job. It was the last job I had in advertising. And I got fired. And I deserved to be. I was so fractured. I could barely speak English. I was just through. And so we're in New Hampshire, and we took everything, put it in a big, you know, moving van and moved. Now we got to get back, and I got no money. It's over. Marie worked a temp job, and it was over for her, and so it's time to come back to Colorado to go home. And so a friend of mine gave us $1,500, and we got a van, and we started head back. And we got back to Denver, and we got into an apartment with whatever was left over. And I started looking for work, and I could not find any work. And there were two parts to that. One of them is I had the skills, but I was older, and the whole culture had moved on, and they were doing advertising. I didn't even recognize. I don't know what it is. And so, and the other part was that I was shattered. And so I got my first job back in Denver was painting apartments for $7 an hour, riding to work on a bicycle, after six figures. And I was working for a guy I sponsored, and he let me just cut in, you know, parts of the room, and he was a professional painter. And that was my first job. And then Marie got a job, and a temp job, and I was making $7 an hour, you know, and then I worked my way up. I think I might have made $8.75 or something. And I am in a company that does entry of all credit card transactions for two hospitals. You know what I mean? And so you have to manually enter these things on 10 key. And like, I am like, you know, on the computer. It's like the number deal. I'm over on that. I'm in a small room with this guy, a young, much younger man, who has apparently got 15 fingers on each hand.
And I'm listening to him, and he's going, doing his stuff. And I'm over there hunting and pecking. And I got my lunch in a brown bag. And this lady came, one of our supervisors came in one day, and she says, Amen. She says, oh, I got to tell you this first. So I'm working along, and you know, his voice, we're back-to-back with each other in like a closet doing this thing. And over my shoulder, he says, you like Whitesnake? I don't know what the hell he's talking about. I said, sure. And I get hit with this wall of sound. I mean, it's like Whitesnake. Okay, now I know what Whitesnake is. Anyway, so the lady came to the door, and she says, man, I'm sorry to tell you, but we have to let one of you go. And I reached down for my bag, and she let him go. If you think God's generosity can be outdone, you're really kidding yourself. So I'm standing, I'm in there, and I'm still doing the thing. And then they offered me a job. And so I said, you know, no. And we moved on, and then I went into another one, and I did that again. And then there came a day when that temporary assignment was through, and I went to work for a mail-order pharmacy, doing the work of a fourth grader. I would get the order for the you know, drugs, and I would pair it with a sheet with the, you know, the patient's name, and pass it on to a pharmacy tech. So all of us fourth graders were in the front of the building. In the back of the building were these pharmacy techs. So I looked at that situation and I said, you know, there's a way that could go smoother. So I said to one of the bosses, I said, you know, maybe if we did this, it would work out better. I got fired the next day. Because I forgot who I was. I was like the lowest form of life on the food chain. And so I get fired. I mean, I lost the job of a fourth grader. I'm going, yes. So the next day, and I got a call later that afternoon, and this lady who was at the temp agency, she said, Mickey, we have a job for you. It's only 4 blocks from where you're working now. And meanwhile, P.S., I am Mr. $11.50 an hour. And it's for the same pay. It's 4 blocks away. It's called BK Entertainment. BK Entertainment. I used to be a singer. What? I mean, this is right up my alley here. I go over, and it's like this, what do they call it? A technical, you know, it's like Soviet-style buildings, all one story, and each door is another business. And so I go to the address on it, you know, and I'm looking for BK Entertainment, and I look at the number, and the number is right, but I see this like piece of legal paper scrawled, hand scrawled, it's curling up at the bottom, and it, BK Entertainment, right? Bingo King. I'm going to work for Bingo King? I looked at that piece of paper, and I said, God, you cannot possibly mean for me to go in there, and actually he did. So I go into Bingo King, and there it is, man. How many times do you have to hit bottom and bounce is the point of this story. But in any event, apparently I wasn't done yet in the rotisserie. God's saying, you think you've hit bottom, son? You just hang on, brother. We're going to get there. So, and people would ask me, where are you working these days? I ain't telling them. I am not telling somebody I now work for Bingo King. So I got in there, and you guys taught me that you do a day's labor for a day's wage. And so what I did is I was in the shipping department, and they make electronic bingo units, and they ship them all over the world. And so they had one part of the building, they were making the things, and I was in the shipping department. It was very complicated. So I asked my boss, I said, can you give me a couple of days so I can look at Microsoft Word and understand how to do it so I can make a track of how this happens. So I made this little manual of how you do this. And we're going along, and I liked it. I like clerical work. When I was in college, I did this Cooter preference test, you know, for what is your aptitude. And, you know, I told you I'm a Catholic, and so I did this thing, and it came up that my number one thing that I am apt to do is clerical. I thought they wanted me to be a priest. Anyway, okay. And that's true. Anyway, so I'm in there, I'm doing this thing, and I asked the people, I said, you know, I'd like to work here. Could I have a job? And the guy said, no. The boss says, no, Mickey. He said, there's somebody coming in, and they're going to take your job. And so I said, okay. It was his girlfriend. And so the girlfriend got the job, and I got bounced out of Bingo King. And I told people, and while I was in there, I looked one day, I wanted to know, how do you get bright red leather? It came in out of Mars. How do you get bright red leather? Because if you take dye and you get a vegetable tan piece of leather and you put red dye on it, it looks the color of dried blood. It's red brown. How do you get bright red? I thought, well, who would know that? And so I go up to the computer and I'm looking. I thought a custom cowboy bootmaker would know how you get that. So I find this guy in New Mexico, and I call him, and I asked him, how do you get that? He says, you can't do that. You got to go to a tannery. And they do it. And so I was looking, then I looked further down, and it said there was a guy in Arvada, which is a suburb of Denver, and he's been making custom cowboy boots for 58 years, and he teaches. So I walk away from the computer, and I stopped, and I said, God, is this what you want me to do? And there was this big hand in my back. And it put me back in the computer, and I started studying under this man, and we've been making custom cowboy boots for 16 years. But I tell you, I told people, if I ever had to write my autobiography, the title of the autobiography would be The Bingo King. Okay, apparently our time is done. Did you want to say anything?
No. Okay. I will later.
Blah, blah,
I got
blah,
involved
blah, blah.
In the story.
We have 5 more minutes, Marie. You're on.
Oh. You know, I have to say that so many of the things that I've learned have been directly from these so-called really bad situations. I remember we would go to church, and I would be sitting there just. The tears just coming down my face because we didn't have any money. How do you survive without money? You know, it's not coming in. We don't have prospects. And as I look back, I see the progress of that particular thing. And it would be, you know, the money would come in, it would be okay. And then we didn't have any money, the money would come in, it would be okay. And that process of total instability finally trained me that God's going to come through. He's going to do what he does, just like you were saying. You know, it's like he's going to show up. He's showing up all the time. And finally... I don't know, years later, what I see inside of myself is, and we're still in a, you know, sometimes we have money, sometimes we don't. When we don't, it's like, there's no blip on my spirit because I really am trusting God. That came directly from not having what I thought we needed. It didn't come from... you know, a solid position of, you know, we have $1 million in the bank so we can always fall back on that. It came from not having anything and being okay. So, you know, there are a million ways in which I have been reassured that really there's nothing I have to worry about. You know, I have to worry about my spirit. I have to worry about whether... I am integrity. I have to worry about whether I'm being honest. I have to worry about whether I'm being of service to other people. Other than that, the rest of the stuff God takes care of. And really, truly, if you're going through some hard times, it's a blessing. I can't remember who the saint was, but she said, you know, if you knew what trials were to your soul, you would ask for more trials, hardships, because it trains us. It gives us the strength of our soul to face the stuff that's going to come up. One other story. I'll tell you this, another one of those proofs of God to me. I came into my meeting, the first meeting I went to, and I still go to that. It's still my home group. It's been going on for 50 years. And there was a lady there who just somehow didn't take to me. She took away from me. She hated me. I must have looked like her bad Aunt Tilda or something. And she immediately couldn't stand me. And she made it known to me in various ways. And so I was going to the meeting, and I would come home, and I'd go, do you know what she did this time? And Mickey said, well, you know, change meetings. And I said, no, this is the strongest meeting in Denver. So I stayed, and I stayed, and she hated me, and she hated me. And every birthday meeting, you know, we kind of take cookies and celebrate our birthday, and I would say, well, you know, I've been in for so many years, you know, 15 years or whatever, and it would get around to her, and she'd say, well, you know, I've been in longer than Marie, you know, and this whole kind of routine that she would do. And finally, somewhere around 20, 25 years, she came up to me, and she says, I need to make an amends to you. And I said, okay. And she says, I've always hated you. And I said, and? That was it. She didn't have the greatest program, okay? But anyhow, what happened to me in that relationship? You know, I of course, I wrestled with it. But what happened to me was that my greatest fear, I mean, I wanted to be invisible, but if you didn't like me, that was the thorn in my life. So the greatest fear I had was somebody didn't like me. You know, actively didn't like me. And here I am 25 years into somebody weekly not liking me. And I didn't die. It was wonderful. It was like, oh my gosh, it doesn't kill me. And it was, I to this day think it was one of the best lessons I ever got. You know, I love all of you, but, you know, if you don't like me, it's pretty much your problem, you know? Unless you want to talk to me and say, you know, this is what you did, or, you know, this is how you affect me, or whatever, you know, we can talk about it. But that's not who I was when I came in. I was petrified that you wouldn't like me. And I would do anything and everything, including going against my integrity to make you like me. So thank you, Sylvia. She has passed on. I now have more time in the program than she did.
I got one last thing to offer. I would be praying to God, God, we need more money. God, we need more money. And finally, in prayer, I got this. Mickey, you don't need more money. You need more God.